I sat there in front of, you know, 40-odd players and just spilled my heart out, mate. Spilled it all.
What was it like in that moment when you were doing that? Can you remember how you were feeling?
Man, I was shit scared.
Oh, yeah.
I was absolutely shitting myself because I thought the boys were going to judge me. I was just thinking all these negative thoughts. But after, I just felt a weight of the world just lifted. You know, I just didn't have to be this person anymore. I didn't have to pretend with people. I could be myself.
Hika Elliott, welcome to What Makes You Tick. Can you hear me?
Yep, I'm all good.
Happy days. Hika, great to have you on board. For people who don't know you, I met you 3 years ago, Hika. We were only saying it there. I met you 3 years ago when my cousin Frank was playing with yourself in Nevers, in France. And what you only realized, I think, recently is that you had a massive influence in me setting up this podcast from our conversations about life, about culture. I think if the sun hadn't had to come up, we'd still be there talking. It was an important moment in my journey, and I think it's fitting to have you on board. So welcome along. Good to have you, pal.
Thank you, mate. Very blessed to be a part of this, and yeah, really looking forward to getting into it.
Super. So why don't we just do that? Why don't we get into it? I think you're born in New Zealand, right? And if people are watching this on YouTube or wherever, you'll see an unbelievable image in the background there. But I think we'll talk to that in a minute. Obviously, rugby is a massive part of your life, and I think most New Zealanders. But before we get into the rugby, like, talk to me about what life was like for you growing up in New Zealand. What's your first memory as a young boy?
My first memories of growing up is we grew up in housing complex, you know, a big family. We didn't come from much, but I know we'll touch on it soon, but I think sports in our team was really the savior for us as youngsters, as people, because I think as I'll touch on later on, there's some of my siblings took another track, and I think that sports for me has definitely been my outlet and given me the opportunity to serve my people, serve my family, and be able to provide for my family.
So when you'd say that you come from the kind of the housing area, like, what was life like growing up? Was it tough? Was you fighting for everything that you earned? Like, what was it kind of like for a youngster?
Oh, mate, you know, there were days that we would go without food. There were days that, you know, the power would turn off. I remember vividly after my parents split up, I think I was 8 years of age, that we used to go to these public pools in a pretty affluent area of Hawke's Bay, but we actually lived in the poverty part of this so-called suburb. So this suburb in New Zealand has apparently got the most millionaires per capita in New Zealand. But I lived in a place where it was predominantly Māori. It was sort of like the throwaways, the castaways of this sort of area of town. And I grew up on Lipscomb Crescent, and the Mongol mob, the gang life, the alcohol abuse, drug abuse was just rampant throughout my street. So it's all I ever knew, mate. You know, that side of things, and that's why I say that for me, rugby is. I hear this thrown around a lot that rugby is just a game, but for me, you know, I get a little bit emotional talking about it. But for me, it's been a lifesaver, and not only that, but it's been a way where it's been an outlet for me, because you know, I've struggled through a lot of mental health issues, especially when I was younger, and adapting to coming from that kind of environment and then being thrust into the limelight of professional rugby at a really relatively it was a young age.
What was it like though? Did you have a really good mentor or coach that saw something in you to help you move from that world that you were kind of surrounded in into a world of rugby? Like there was obviously a raw talent, or there was something in you. You said you used it as an outlet. Was it an outlet for, as a young person, for, like, I used it myself as aggression, as a way to kind of release aggression legally? Do you know what
yeah
I mean?
well for me it was definitely, you know, we grew up in a household of, actually we were martial artists before I was a rugby player, so my older siblings were all world class karate champs. My brothers and sisters all black belts, so am I. They all went to world champs. My brother was like at the time he was a 3-4 time world champ, karate champ. So, you know, rugby was sort of come after that, and even after basketball for me, I stopped growing. So, you know, it was just an outlet, but more of a sanctuary for us, you know, to escape the environment that, you know, of having nothing and coming from nothing. I had a fair bit of talent when I was younger. I made a heap of rep teams, but we never had a car. So I used to have to, the coach of any rep team would have to come pick me up, take me to trainings, and, you know, give me money so I could go on these trips, and because they really wanted me to go on these trips. So, you know, as tough as it was, and to be a proud, it come from a proud family where we didn't really, you know, we didn't ask for help, you know, we just struggled through, and it was sort of like a cycle that you know, my parents come from as well. So you only know what you know. So
do you find it hard to ask for help now, or has that changed?
No, I don't think so, because I've touched on a little bit, you know, there have been times in my life where, you know, I have struggled with my mental health, especially early on in my career, and past trauma that I suffered as a youngster growing up. I really didn't have the adequate tools to be able to cope with that. So, you know, when I look back on my career, I have a few regrets about not where I am now, but what my career could have been in New Zealand, and especially in the black jersey.
Go on, talk to me on that. What regrets would you have on that? Because that's a big statement.
Yeah, like for me, you know, with 2008 was my first year in the All Blacks. So, and at this time, I was a pretty angry sort of teenager growing up in an environment where our first 15 would, you know, if we're in town, we're partying, we wouldn't have any qualms about, you know, getting into fights with older dudes, and this was on the regular.
Yeah,
you know, we, close friend of mine, we had a big fight with the local gang down there. He ended up getting stabbed and died right in front of our eyes, you know, and this is one of the street fights that we had. So this kind of trauma growing up with it, I sort of took that into, you know, my first few years, actually first 4, 5, 6 years of my professional life. And I made the Hurricanes after a few years playing first division footy, made the Hurricanes as a 20, 21-year-old, signed a 4-year contract. By the end of that season, they didn't want me in the team, you know, so... By the end of that 2008, I'd already made the All Blacks as well. The trip to Munster, we'll talk about that soon. But after that trip, you know, I just wasn't equipped to cope with the shit that I was going through that had resurfaced from when I was a youngster, and it was alcohol. And you know, if someone looked at me funny or said something funny to me or tried to step to me in any way, I didn't have the tools to be able to, you know, bring myself down. The first thing I would do was, you know, let's go, let's do this. I wouldn't care where it was, in the middle of the street, in the pub, or anywhere it was. You know, I say this to people now, that I just didn't have an off switch. You know, I went from 0 to 100 really, really quickly. And when I look back now, I think it was a survival thing for me growing up because I had to be that way. It was, either you or me. And that's the way it was where I grew up, and that's how I learned. It was a learned behavior. And I didn't really have any role models in my family, even surrounding family, because I come from a family, close family, wider family of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, gang affiliation. So I didn't really have any positive role models that were stable role models in my life. And I've got a pretty good relationship with my brother at the moment, but he's sort of 10, 11 years older than me. He said one of his regrets was not being the older brother I needed when I was a youngster coming through, because I said to him that, one of my fucking, excuse the language, but
You're fine. You can curse away. There's no problem.
one of my biggest regrets is that, especially when it comes to my career, is that I wasn't on the straight and narrow from the get-go, because I am now, and I have been for quite a few years. I'm really, really settled, and I understand that it wasn't me as a youngster. It wasn't my fault. It's things that had happened to me that I just didn't have the tools, or I wasn't equipped to deal with the emotions that surfaced every time I would get myself into these situations where normal people would just walk away. And so at the end of 2008, the Hurricanes sat me down. They're like, "No, nah, you're out of here." And then I made the All Blacks on the back of that. Got called in, actually. And the first thing that they done, I got off the plane, had dinner, put me straight into a room, mate, with all the senior players, all the coaches. This is me as a buddy, 20, 21-year-old, sat me down in this room and just went to town on me. About you're this, you're that, you're in this environment, this is how it is. And I'm like, fuck, man, why did you pick me if this was my thinking at the time? Why did you pick me if you're just gonna bring me into this environment and try and control me like this? And looking back, I know what they were trying to do. They saw a talented young footy player who wasn't equipped enough to be able to cope with with getting this professional contract, having this money, no financial, sort of processes in place, and didn't really have any role models around me to sort of lend to for advice. So for me, the first few years in that environment was a pretty I wouldn't call it traumatic. It was a daunting sort of process for me, and I felt really out of place. I felt like a lot of the professional environments I had to conform to a lot of the way it is, because it is an old boys club, I suppose, in footy these days, if I'm allowed to say that. But I'm going to say it anyway because I'm
Say
pretty
it.
honest and upfront, mate. So it definitely wasn't a environment that was conducive to who I was as a person.
Fascinating. It is fascinating to know that while you didn't have the tools at that time when you were younger to deal with them, you have them now. And what I see in you now is a man with like super respect, super amount of discipline. Like following you on social media as well, like you ooze an unbelievable amount of class, and you use your platform now to inspire others because you've walked that walk and you've been down those dark paths and those dark avenues, and you've been in those areas where you know it's tough, and you found a way out of it. I suppose let me go back to your family a little bit, and that how many of you was there in your family? Because it wasn't a small family, right?
I wasn't a small family, so I've got four sisters. We had four sisters. We have two whānau sisters that grew up with us. So
What does
whānau
that mean?
sister.
What does that mean?
So being whānau in Māoridom is equivalent of the of adoption without the paperwork. So yeah, so there was a whānau, and we had two of my sisters were pregnant at the we're mothers at 16. So so we're living in a three bedroom house with a lot of people, with my nephews growing up in the house as well, my nephew and my niece. So my niece now is my nephew, he's the oldest. He's 27 now, 28, and my niece is, well, she's pretty much my daughter because my mother and me brought her up right from 5 months of age. So she's my younger sister's firstborn. My sister had her when she was 16. My mum took her, didn't take her, but my sister gave her to my mum when she was 5 months of age, and I was the only sibling living with my mum at the moment at that time. So, I was the one that was changing her nappies. I was 19 years old, and sort of just cracked professional rugby as an 18, 19 year old. So yeah, she went everywhere with me, and she's my little girl. So yeah, it was a
Isn't it interesting there, Hika? Like you look at two, you're talking about 18, 19 years old, all right? So on one side of things, you're getting offered a contract to be a professional rugby player, and you're about to play for the All Blacks, and you have this anger that you're figuring out or trying to manage, right? And then on the other side, then you're this lovable older father figure to this little child who needs your help and needs your support, and there's the kind of the care and the commitment to family. There's kind of two different versions of the
Of
one
me,
person.
yeah. Well, I think we'll probably touch on a little bit later, but it was the way that I lived a lot of my career as two people. You know,
Talk to me about that.
there was the outgoing side of Hika that everybody loved, that everybody thought was positive and always upbeat. But then there was a Hika that was struggling with shit and trauma that occurred when I was a youngster, when I was a kid, that I had no way of dealing with. So alcohol was an outlet for me. It always brought out the best, but it also brought out the worst of me. So yeah, there was definitely two sides of Hika. There was two different Hikas that my teammates, my family saw for a very long time. And it wasn't until I left New Zealand that my sisters and my family found out about this trauma that I suffered at the hands of people growing up. So,
Oh, so how did they find out?
I just had enough. I just had enough, and I just blurted out to my older sisters, and they were like, "What the fuck?" And my sisters and my brothers have been through abuse as well. So, not just physical violence, but sexual abuse as well. So, I know it's a little bit heavy, but
Yeah,
it's
it's important. I think it's important to hear the story, man, because that's your story isn't just about what we see on social media or what you do in rugby. Like, I think there's the sum of the parts which form who you are, and that's why I've asked you to come on, you know.
Yeah, exactly, mate. And I've already touched on it. For a long time, I was an angry man, angry young boy, and I didn't understand why, couldn't understand why. Had a few episodes. I played at the Chiefs for 10 years. I had a few bumps in the roads, but nothing like I did at the Hurricanes. It was always been up. I was always able to bring myself back, and I never got to a point where it was a career ending. Like, I almost thought it was going to be back in 2008 after I returned from my tour to Ireland and the UK. At the end of that tour, I got in some pretty serious trouble, mate.
Did you? What happened?
So I went to a awards night, was up for Māori Sportsman of the Year. Had a few too many beers, and sure enough, that young fella, that angry fella, come out, it was actually through the grace of a good cop who was the one that was called. He took me back to my hotel room, and I had no recollection of him, mate. had no recollection of the evening. And then I had to be sat down in front of New Zealand Rugby Union, told this and that, this and that, this is what happened. And I'm like, fuck, I'm done, at the age of, 21 years of age.
Yeah.
So.
That's hard to take, man. That's hard to take, especially when you don't remember yourself doing it, right?
Yeah, well, it was, but I was like, fuck, man. I still didn't have the tools to understand, what I was going through, what my mind was going through, where my head was at. Didn't understand why I would do this stuff under the influence of alcohol, why I would feel this way. So, I just wasn't equipped, mate. I just wasn't equipped. So that's how my family found out. And then in 2000, before I come over to France, I was meant to play in a tens competition over in Brisbane for the first time. And I was on some medication from a psychologist. So I was on some medication from a psychologist to help me process and help me out with my mental state. And I was getting help. I had been getting help for about a year and a half, 2 years prior to this, seeing doctors and just trying to equip myself with the tools that I needed to get myself through life, because at that stage it had become pretty hard for me to function both in a rugby environment and for me as a person.
Okay.
So at this tournament, I ended up actually overdosing on the pills that the psychologist had prescribed for me. And the thing was I didn't want to kill myself. I just wanted a break from the mental shit that was going through my head. So my teammates found me combing out in the corridor of the hotel. Apparently, I knocked on my manager's door. He thought I was pissed up, but when he was talking to me, he was like, "No, you're not pissed up. There's something going on." So they took me back to my room. I sat the tournament out. Woke up the next day, not knowing what had happened. They sent me back on a plane, and then I was like, "This is it. I'm just gonna." Tell them what's going on. I'm sick and tired of being this person that is always up, but at home I'm always down.
Yeah.
And I can't get why my thoughts are doing what they're doing. So it's the hardest thing that I've ever had to do in my whole rugby career was on a Monday after they had, or Tuesday after they had returned from Brisbane, was to sit in front of 40 men from my rugby team and sit there on a chair and say, "Lads, I'm not okay. There have been demons that I've been fighting since I was a youngster that have got a hold of me. This has happened, that's happened, and I'm not okay. I need help. I just need you guys to know, because I heard the rumors. I heard that the boys, I had a meeting with the coaches prior to it. I told them my story. My history, sat there with Renz and our manager for probably about 3 hours before going into this meeting, teary-eyed, emotional, and I just let it all out, mate. Just let it all out. This is what happened, growing up, and this is what happened. I just haven't been equipped with the tools to be able to be able to deal with this stuff, especially under the influence of anything. So I sat there in front of, 40-odd players and just spilled my heart out, mate. Spilled it all.
What was it like in that moment when you were doing that? Can you remember how you were feeling?
Man, I was shit scared.
Oh, yeah.
I was absolutely shitting myself because I thought the boys were going to judge me. I was just thinking all these negative thoughts. But after, I just felt a weight of the world just lifted. I just didn't have to be this person anymore. I didn't have to pretend with people. I could be myself.
Amazing.
And since that moment, mate, I've being able to have these discussions openly and honestly with a lot of my close friends, friends that I've been friends with for 20 years. So we'll go back a little bit. In Brisbane, when this happened, I had a night, I stayed with one of my best friends growing up, who we got in trouble with a lot growing up. You know, it had been over 20 years of friendship. And I shared with him my story, you know, from a young lad growing up. And he was like, fuck, man. Why has it come to this that you're telling me now? And, you know, me and him just hugged each other and cried, yeah. You know, and he just couldn't believe that I'd been, had this inside me all these years. And, you know, he thought I was this go-get-it kind of person, you know, this and that, and was always up and joyful about everything, which I was, but behind closed doors, you know, it was a different thing. So going back to telling the boys, it was, yeah, I just felt a sense of relief after that. You know, I could finally be myself, be the hooker that I knew I could be. You know, like I said, I'd been getting help for a wee while then. And
did the guys, so, and it probably doesn't matter, but were you surprised with their reaction?
No, I wasn't surprised, because telling them a lot of my story, I didn't really go into, well, I did tell them a lot of the story, but I didn't go into in-depth about the story, because, it's a pretty ugly story to tell people. And unless you're prepared and you have a open mindedness and a willingness to accept this kind of stuff actually goes on, then you're probably not in the best place to hear the story.
Yeah.
You know? So you know, I was I told them what they needed to know.
And then you went and got the support and the help that you needed then at that time, I presume, did you?
Yeah. Well, I had already been getting help, but
yeah,
I hadn't shared any of my struggle with anybody.
Yeah.
It was still there. It was still there manifesting itself inside me. And I've bottled this up since a youngster. And to finally be able to tell people was liberating, you know, for me to be able to just, you know,
let loose. I think it's interesting in that. So New Zealand and Ireland, very similar in certain ways, right? Small nation, but boxing above our weight in many different ways, right? But we obviously, Irish have a kind of a unique culture as well within our lands, right? But then within New Zealand, there's the Maori culture, and obviously, as a young man, you were getting put forward as the Maori Sports Person of the Year. What does the Maori culture kind of mean to you? And maybe is there a way that you can kind of explain it for those who aren't necessarily au fait with it, from who are outside New Zealand?
How can I best describe what Maori culture is to me? It's I suppose we're spiritual, very spiritual people. You know, I come from a long line of warriors, so I suppose that's where I get my bloody anger and anger issues from, isn't it? Not anymore, but you know, we can explain it in a lot of ways. I think it's, for me, it was just, it's awesome to be a part of something greater than myself, because that's what Māori Dim is about. It's about whanaungatanga, manaakitanga.
What does that mean?
Manaakitanga is about bringing people together, respecting your elders. You know, all the Pacific cultures sort of identify with the same values.
Mm-hmm.
So when I sit down with Samoans and Fijians, when I look at them, I see myself, and I miss that a lot. I grew up speaking Māori. I went to a total immersion Māori school, and then I couldn't read or write in English until I actually got to high school. I had to learn to read and write in English because I got a rugby scholarship to go to one of the top rugby schools from where I'm from, and I had to take remedial study classes, mate. So that was me 2-3 times a week taking remedial study English classes just to learn to read or write in English. So, as you can imagine, being an angry dude, pretty big boy, and not being able to read or write in English, and kids, sort of mocking you for not being able to read and write. It wasn't the greatest experience, but it's definitely put me in good stead. But the Māori culture, the haka is renowned for it. We're a warrior people. Our bloodline is who we are. I'm just glad that, for the first sort of 15 years of my life, that I was really immersed in our Māori culture, because living in the world that I do now, in this rugby world, it's been hard for me to really get back to my roots, to my people, to my marae, to my hope, to my ope, to my people. And because they say in Māoridom, your marae and your people and your rohe is really what grounds you. If you know where you come from, it doesn't matter if you're if because blood quantum in Māoridom is not a thing. If you can fuck a papa back, if you have genealogy back to a certain part of New Zealand, to land, to your whenua, because your whenua is what grounds you. When you put your feet back on your whenua, you're home, and that's what grounds you to your people. That's when the spirits of your ancestors flow from the ground, they come up, and you breathe them in.
Oh wow, my goodness. I'll back you. I'll fight with you. It leads me to we you mentioned the haka there, and I think it was it against Wales, you were playing with the Chiefs. You led a haka against them. Would I be right in saying that?
Yep, that's right. And the Lions as well.
And the Lions, yeah. So
Yeah.
what was it like? What's it like to lead men of that stature into battle against others? And I think there's obviously there's the respect, but there's also the haka is we're you're challenging us and we're challenging you. We're ready to lay down. What talk to me about that when you're going through that moment.
I think for me, there's a couple of differences between kamate, the New Zealand haka, with New Zealand Māori haka, which I was fortunate to lead, and the Chiefs haka, because the Chiefs haka, I had a pretty significant role in what that haka was gonna, how that haka was going to be, what was going to be written in that haka, what we wanted to portray to the people, and how we wanted people to see us, and what and the words and the meaning of that haka was. So the Chief's haka talks about grounding yourself, and writing your name in the stars. So before we won our two championships, this haka was composed by a man called Ōrakihi, who us there was a couple of senior players, myself, Liam, and Tanero Latame had a lot of influence into, like I just said, how this haka was going to be performed. So, and where it was performed, so Waikato Stadium is an old pā ground. So it's a war pā. There used to be battles that used to take place on that actual field. Yeah, so there's a line that says Ruana te whenua, Ruana te whenua. So the ground will shake as we run out, and we talk about writing our names in the star. But to be able to perform that haka on that ground in that moment against those teams, mate, it was such an emotional and such a blessing for me. And to have that much on an influence with the culture of the Chiefs over my time there, as a strong Māori boy growing up, that come from the bad side of the tracks, you know, and to be able to have that role thrust upon me from my fellow players and the coaches and the elders of the area, you know, it was a pretty surreal experience. We actually visited a site where the Battle of Rangiriri, they call it, where there was a battle between the tribe there and the crown, where the crown come up and they done this and done that, and that was signified in the haka as well. So that was pretty cool.
I think what's fascinating is that you're essentially, when you talk about the fana and being part of the ground, right? That essentially you're part of the DNA of the Chiefs now forever. You know, like in that you have created that legacy that your kids are going to see and the family will see, and that when they look back in years to come, that while you may talk about coming from the bad side of the tracks, there's always a reason, and that side of the tracks helped mold you to become a massive influential part of that haka, which will live on forever, right?
It's funny you say that, because yeah, you're right. You know, as many times as I've looked back on my career and you know, had these regrets, I also have had these awesome moments where I've been a part of these awesome environments where, like you've just said, that I've created something or been a part of creating something that's going to go on for years and years and years to come, you know. You know, makes me really, really proud to have been a part of that and part of that jersey and fill the jersey in some way that I did.
You should be very proud, man. I think, take me back to 2008. And the reason I find this quite, I'm getting goosebumps even talking about it. So I was in New Zealand. I was traveling the world in 2008, right? And I was in America, and I was with a good friend of mine, Stevie Walsh. And Stevie and I were in Huntington Beach, and we were living our best lives. I went over to the States, I met him. And the week before Munster were due to play New Zealand, Steve rings me in America, and he rings me and he said, "Brads," it's not the lads call me, "Brads, Shane is dead," right? And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, "Gagsy, Shane Gagan was a guy I played rugby with in Garryowen. And he was one of Steve's best mates. And he was a friend of mine from playing rugby." He said, "Gagsy's dead." And I was like, "Hold on, how did that happen?" Essentially what happened was there was a family feud going on at the time. And it was a mistaken identity. And they chased him down and they killed him, right? And Gagsy was supposed to go to that game in New Zealand against Munster in Thomond Park. It was the opening of Thomond Park, the new Thomond Park. And I remember my family sent over the DVD. I was staying with a friend of mine, Andre Ellison. He played with the Chiefs as well many, many moons ago. But I was staying with Andre, and I got the DVD, and I watched it. It was the DVD at the time. Mad, forever ago. But I watched it, and in the opening before the game, they pay homage and respect to Shane, and they left his seat empty, the seat that he was supposed to stay in. And I was like, he'll forever live in that moment. Like, you can never take that away from him. And then all these years later, I meet you who, for the first time, 2008, you put on the All Blacks jersey on that day. And now we're here. And I think there's something in that, in terms of, I don't know, some sort of connections or the way the world works or whatever it is. And I know we spoke about this before, but take me back to 2008, Thomond Park, you playing New Zealand, playing Munster against three of your fellow Kiwis. And what was it like? What did that game mean to you? What did that moment mean to you?
Mate, the build up to the week was huge. You know, it was my first weekend with the All Blacks in Ireland, and we actually went to the play alone in the stands.
Alone at stands, yeah.
Yeah. So watching this play, and I'm like, "Whoa, what are we in for this?" I think this was on a Tuesday. I was like, "What are we in for?" Not knowing what we're in
And
for.
for anybody who hasn't heard about Alone It Stands, it's a play based on Munster beating the All Blacks back in
30 years.
1978. So this is the 30-year anniversary, and we've been hanging on to that ever since.
And you know, I didn't really know any of the backstory to this, so to be able to go there and experience this, I was like, holy moly, he's young me. I'm like, I'm in for it this week, aren't I? But at the same time, really excited by the opportunity and the challenge to be able to represent my country for the first time. So we've done that, we've done the whole all of that, and then the start of it was a blur, but standing out there in front of the crazy crowd, and your cousin, he was there.
Yeah.
What it was, he was 11 or 12. He keeps remind,
Yeah,
he keep,
Frank was only a young fella. Like he was probably 11, yeah, 11 or 12.
yeah. He keeps reminding me. He was like, "I was at the game. I was only 11. You old ass."
Yeah, and then next thing, 10 years later, he's playing alongside you in the bear.
Crazy, crazy, but it was just an awesome build up to find out the history of the park and the history of what the people of that area had gone through, the significance of what that game meant to the people running out. Man, the crowd was electric, and to do the national anthems, mate, that was unreal. And looking at the boys when they done the haka, man, that was something special. That was something special. I knew we were going to be in for a tough night. I could just see it on the faces. But to perform it back, it was unreal, and it was an awesome opportunity for a young boy from a small town to be able to represent my family on the biggest stage. And I remember, I think it was like 18 minutes to go where I got the call to, or 20 minutes to go, I got the call, warm up, you're going on. And I'm like, man, we're down by 2 points. We're down by 2 points, and they're putting me on. And I remember my first throw was a throw to the back. We played on, and a few minutes later we had another attacking line out on the 22, attacking 22. And I was like, please don't call it to the back. Please don't call it to the back. Sure enough, they call it to the back. And I'm like, please get this right. Otherwise, my All Blacks career is going to be done. I'm not going to be a part of the team losing to Munster 30 years on the anniversary. My career is going to be done, mate. So I ended up throwing this line out in. And a few phases later, Joe Rococo scored in the corner. So it was just such a relief, because
Heartbreaking.
that game for us, the Munster boys just gave it to us, absolutely gave it to us, forced us into errors. I've looked back on the game a couple of times recently, actually. And man, it was an ugly game from us, but people say, "Oh, you guys played so badly," but the Munster boys just put us under so much pressure and had so much desire to beat us that they forced us into areas that normally these players don't make.
And
So
there was a lot of lads who were playing for Ireland as well, so they weren't released. So it was for a lot of the boys that was their final. It was their moment. It was their moment in the sun, and that was it. Never will they get that opportunity again, potentially. And a lot of them didn't. But it's incredible. It's amazing how we can connect it, though, isn't it? Like how it's all kind of come around full circle. And you mentioned family there. You're growing a family of your own now, and your beautiful lady is expecting. And I think, like, talk to me about your family. Like, what words would you use to describe your family and what they mean to you?
Oh, my family is my why. They are they're my son, my wife, my daughter to come, my daughter back home. my immediate family, but especially my kids and my wife. They're why I still do what I'm doing at almost 37 years of age. You know, I'm turning 37 in a couple of months, but my mind has never been more focused on what I need to do to be able to continue to play, because I love playing footy, mate. You know, I wish I could play till I'm bloody 100, because I absolutely love it. I'm a rugby head through and through. And, you know, now that I'm in a mind space that I am at the moment and that I'm focused, you know, I think anything's still possible, even at my age. But, you know, there's a lot of love in my house. We love our kids. My son's just an absolutely beautiful, handsome young boy with such good manners. I don't know where he gets that from.
Harley's doing a great job.
but, you know, there's a lot of love in this house. We try and spend a lot of time together. Yeah, and I'm just loving being a father. You know, I'm loving this time of my life, not only at home, but also in my rugby and what I do to provide for my family. I take pride in being able to fulfill that role for my family, and being of the state of mind and the physical being to be able to do so. So, you know, I only just wish that I had this kind of focus and this mentality when I was a young buck. But, yeah, my family is my why. They're my everything, you know. And I would push mountains and do anything and go to the ends of the earth for my family. So, yeah.
And, I think it also, like, it's you're able to provide as well the support and the kind of the maybe the things that potentially were missing when you were young, your son is going to get, and your daughter and everything are going to get to see how much support you can actually bring them by being there, being present, and being able to do what it is that you wish to do for them. And I think Hicke, like the trials and tribulations that you've gone through has helped form this wonderful human being and a really, really strong, focused, disciplined person, which I think as a role model for young boys and girls, even your teammates, I think it's fantastic to see. And I'd love to maybe ask you, if you were speaking to 8-year-old Hicke, what advice would you give him, or what would you say to him?
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one, because what advice would I give an 8-year-old Hicke? I think trust yourself, and anything is possible, but also your past doesn't define who you are. What has happened to you doesn't define who you are, so you're going to be okay.
Nice. Yeah, I think and there's a lot of kids, I'm sure, who are growing up in similar situations in New Zealand at the moment, and I'm sure that they'll take homage. Whoever listens to this will take kind of solace in the fact that they can use you as a role model and somebody to look up to. And I think it's absolutely been a huge privilege chatting to you. And my final question to you, Hicke, is if you were passing by a billboard, right, and there was a headline that you wanted to put up there for people to know who you are and what you're about, what would it say?
Mate. Yeah. You put me on the what would it say?
How would you like people how would you like people to think of you?
Yeah, that's probably easier put there, mate. I'd like to think of me as, I'd like people to think that I'm honest. I'm caring and I'm loyal to the people who are loyal to me.
Super, super. Finally, tell me, what does that picture mean to you behind you? So there's a, for people who mightn't see this, there's an unbelievable picture of the All Blacks. And I can't make out who's who, but what does that picture represent?
Mate, that represents who I am. That's me. That's my people. That represents everything that I've put into this career. It's almost been 20 years, and that was the pinnacle. And when everything is set and done, I'm going to be able to look at them and be like, I was a part of that. That's me. Son, my son's got something to aspire to, because I want him to aspire to be great and to be greater than he could ever imagine. That's just the timely reminder of, when I wake up and I may be having a shit day and having those thoughts, those self-doubt thoughts that, this is what I'm capable of when you put your mind to it. So.
I think that's interesting you say that you do have those days still. So you do have those challenges still. And while not every day is perfect, and I don't think any day is perfect, but there's a big difference between positivity and optimism. Optimism is knowing that there's light at the end of the tunnel,
That's
and it's
right.
real and it's realistic. And listen, this too shall pass. Whereas positivity isn't real. It's okay to be positive at a moment, but you can't maintain that positivity for every challenge in life. So
Exactly.
optimism is knowing that we'll get through this, and it is good that you say that you still have those challenges, but you now have the tools and the wherewithal to figure it out, which is fantastic.
Exactly, mate. Exactly. We've
All
come a
right,
long way.
well, listen, Kamir, thank you so much for joining me, pal. It's been really eye-opening. I think a lot of people will get something out of this. I surely got tons out of it. I think, I'm sorry it's been so long since we spoke, but you're never too far from thoughts. And oh, actually, we never spoke about music. What people don't realize is that Hikka is an unbelievable singer. And I don't know if we'll get a bar out of you now, but there's an incredible video on Hika's social media, which is of him sharing a tune. I don't know who's with you in that, maybe one of your best buds or something, but
Maybe.
sharing a tune and a kind of like a reflection of your career to date. I'll post it in the show notes, Hika, but yeah, music is a big part of your life too, right?
And music brings so much joy and happiness to people's lives, mate. I'll tell you
Happy days. All right. Well, listen, on that note, Hick Elliott, thank you for joining me, pal. And until next time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. It's been an awesome opportunity to be able to share some insight into my life. And thank you for giving me the platform to be able to share with people that may be struggling through things that, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and you're loved. Peace.